So welcome. So we're going to continue this month-long series on investigation, exploring it from different angles. And tonight I'd like to start by kind of giving the big picture of why we even practice, because I think it's important to have that frame when we look at investigation or any spiritual practice. It's really what's the core reason for doing it. So one way we can boil that down is the movement from ignorance to wisdom, or delusion to wisdom. Now, when I use those words, ignorance and delusion, I think it's important to unpack those a little bit, because we often hear that, like, well, that person's ignorant, that person doesn't know as much as I do, or doesn't share the same belief that I do, right? In Buddhism, we're talking about ignorance and delusion as a in a different way, really a confusion about how things really are. It's this deep understanding and alignment of how things are in life, in reality. So there's a sense of not knowing that basic confusion. And wisdom, on the other hand, isn't about having knowledge or having a sense of a big intellect. It's much more being embodied with this sense of how things are. So moving from, we could say, the confusion about how things are to a clarity with how things are. So this is the movement of our practice. So when we act from wisdom, we act from the sense of deep understanding, we experience less suffering. When we act from ignorance or from delusion, we experience more suffering. So Buddhism is a very practical spiritual path. It really comes down to wisdom. It really has very little bearing if it doesn't translate into how much we suffer. And it has to get into our lives, into all these different aspects of our relationships, into our work, into how we live our life, how we relate to ourselves. So an investigation helps to bring to light, where are we acting from a sense of ignorance? Where are we acting from a sense of delusion? And where are we acting from a sense of wisdom? So it starts to become more clear. I'm going to share a little joke. We may not find funny, but we'll see. So there is a man was searching in a dark night under a light lamppost. So there's a circle of light. So he's searching on his hands and knees, looking each inch of that over and over again. Along comes the policeman and asks, "So what are you doing, sir?" And he says, "Well, I'm searching for my car keys." And so they both get down and they're searching for about 20 minutes. And so finally the policeman says, "So where do you think you lost it?" "Oh, over there." He says, "Why are you searching here?" "Because this is where the light is." Okay. So where the light is what's obvious in our practice, what's obvious in our lives. But for our practice to really deepen, we have to be willing to look where it's dark, where it's unconscious, where things aren't seen. Not where it's easy, but actually to look underneath the surface. So if you look at the roots of ignorance and delusion, the sense of confusion, comes down in a very basic way, in a very core and direct way, to these three characteristics, not understanding them. The characteristic of unsatisfactoriness, of things not being quite fulfilling, often translated as a sense of dukkha, or the word dukkha. So that's, so in the moment, it's like, man, there's a friction with that moment. That moment isn't as peaceful as we'd like it to be, right? There's the impermanence, the things are always in flux, always in changing, and the quality of anatta, of non-self, that there's not a concrete, lasting self that we can find that's conditioned based on circumstances, based on many things that come up. So if we don't have an embodied knowledge, embodied understanding of these three characteristics, we're operating in some degree or another from delusion, from ignorance. And so we may have different levels of understanding, but until we fully embody it, there will always be some type of ignorance that's driving our actions, driving how we actually see the world. And then not seeing these three characteristics leads to the other three we often call unwholesome roots. So there's delusion and there's greed and hatred. Now, greed and hatred are kind of heavy words in our culture, right? We have a sense of being greedy is really bad, the sense of hatred. But if we think about if we see the world from this misconception that things are satisfactory, that things have a sense of lasting fulfillment, we have a sense of seeing things as being permanent, which aren't permanent, and seeing a sense of self that's solid when it's not, then these are natural expressions of that belief. I mean, of course we're going to feel a sense of greed, a sense of longing, of wanting, to try to fulfill that sense of self, to try to have that sense of self be more fulfilled. Hatred, in a sense of separation, of movement away from what we don't like. These are natural expressions when we're confused about how things are. These are very deep roots, and they're hard to see. Right? And so investigation starts to give us some inroads to understanding that in a more concrete way. Now, when you think about these three roots of delusion, of hatred, of greed, or the three characteristics of dukkha, of anicca, and of anatta, they often seem very abstract. It's kind of a conceptual thing we have in our life. And so it's not very engaging when it's just in the concept. So it's important for us to move into a felt sense of each of these three, each of these sets, to really understand what does it feel like to be wanting, to have a sense of movement toward life, movement pushing away from life, the sense of being confused about how things are, to really have that deeply in our bodies. Because connecting with the felt sense moves it from the intellect into a deeper organ, the heart, or even the sense of the whole embodiment of it. And that's really important because we can't ultimately let go from the mind, from concept. It's really this letting go happens from the heart. This heart surrender. So if you look at these qualities of greed and hatred and delusion, they're really shaping the way we view life, shaping our thoughts, how we act, how we speak. And especially when we're caught in this cycle of being reactive, of being hooked, of being angry, of being fearful, they come in a very almost subconscious way to form how we actually relate to life. Now, to get a handle on that, steady mindfulness, a sense of steadiness of attention, can be very helpful to start to see that. But if you've ever practiced, if you've gone on a retreat and you try to come back off the retreat and try to sustain that level of steadiness, of samadhi, of one point of focus, you find that life quickly becomes very distracting. And it's hard to be feeling each sensation as you're driving down the freeway. You know, you have to be more open-ended with that. But yet we have this other tool of our reactivity, because our reactivity catches our attention because we don't like it. That sense of being angry, being fearful. And so we can start to use our emotional lives as a cue or as a signal to turn toward and investigate. To actually, this is a time to pay attention. What's going on right now? What's the felt sense of this experience? What's the belief system that's arising? And so tonight we're going to explore how this sense of rub becomes a gateway into understanding these three characteristics and these three roots, to actually see them in a very concrete way in our life. So our life becomes a spiritual practice. And actually the very fabric of our life becomes what we practice with. So the first thing to always do is to connect with what is, to connect with what your experience is in this moment. Not what you think it should be, or how you rather it be, but really, what is it right now? And that actually is a big step. So often we're moving into what we want to be, how we should be, how we don't want to be. There's this sense of always moving, always trying to fine-tune that dial. But just to say, okay, this is how I am right now. My mind is full of thoughts. It's anxious. There's tension in the body, fear, whatever it might be, to fully connect with it, to fully acknowledge it. Think about if you had a friend, that every time you said something to them, you wanted to share something personal, and they would say, oh, let me tell you what you should do. Let me rush in there and try to fix that and try to alter what your experience is. You know, how much would you really share with that person? Or if they're very judgmental of certain things, you would tend to hide those away. So sometimes our mindfulness, our attention is like that friend, that it is very judgmental of our experience. It's okay, if you're loving and happy, but you know, lustful and angry, that's not so good. Okay, so those get pushed away into those dark corners. They get repressed. Or if you're lucky enough to have a friend who completely listens to you, completely opens to you, and has no agenda of how you should act or decide, but just simply receives you and listens, how there's a way that the body relaxes and the heart relaxes. And so naturally we start to share more and more deeply. So in our practice, being like that second friend to ourselves is essential. You know, to cultivate this mindfulness, this attention that sees without agenda. So that's one of the preconditions for investigation to work. Because if we go in with a sense of judgment, we won't see so completely. So that's why the heart has to still feel engaged. The heart has to feel the sense of warmth as it's connecting with what's being seen and connect and observed. So in this moment's experience, when there's a sense of reactivity, there's a sense of feeling hurt, there's anger that comes up, our typical response is to jump right in, to go in and engage with that. So we start to act from that, we start to think from that, and speak from that reactivity. And this is how we often go through life. Now, when we do that, it's important to know how that reinforces the pattern in itself. So what I'm saying is, even this whole pattern of explaining how we typically go into it, it's really helpful to be an observant enough to see how you're engaging it, how you pick up the pieces, how do you act from a reactivity that causes more and more reactivity. So you understand it. You understand it clearly. So when we act from that reactivity, reinforce it, we create conditions for further reactivity. And this triggers reactivity in others. So there's this cycle of hurt that keeps going back and forth. So investigation asks us to observe more and participate less. Okay, so we're observing what's happening. We're seeing, okay, what is really happening in this moment? These patterns of mind, these patterns of belief, the emotionality, the physical sensation, the whole gestalt of it. You're seeing it in a very complete way. So we learn to see the process without becoming lost in it. And that's the key piece, is that we so often get lost in our reactivity, lost in our thoughts, in our beliefs about ourselves and others. And that's where so much of our pain is. And sometimes you listen to someone who's really upset and you just see how much they're invested in that belief system. They're just so caught in it. And you see that if they could just have a bigger perspective, you could see it's just all imaginary. It's especially tragic when you hear about a teenager who committed suicide. And perhaps they were being bullied and just feeling this sense of deep despair. And the only way out they could see was to end their life. But you can see as an adult with a little more perspective, a few more years perspective, that problem that was so urgent would fall away. So we learn to take the heart of our problems and be a little bit more spacious around it, a little broader perspective. Not pushing it away, just not engaging with it, not being so caught in it. Because when we're caught in it, our actions really want to flow from that. So the hardest thing to do with it is to do nothing with it, to simply open to it. It's hard initially because we're such a habituated to keep engaging again and again in it. So you have to learn to build this capacity to hold. Last week, someone asked about the exercise. We did an exercise where you're simply noticing where is a resistance in this moment, an out loud meditation. And one person asked, when she did that, she started to find the resistance, it got more intense. And as she stopped resisting her experience, the experience itself started to well up in a stronger way. So we have to have a certain level of capacity to hold that, to meet that. And also the wisdom and compassion to know when it's too much, when this experience is becoming too much for me to hold in this moment. So to consciously decide to broaden my attention, to shift to something else, so my mindfulness is steady. So we meet something we don't grab onto and become tighter around it, we're able to hold it in a gentle way. So this often comes up with trauma, with past abuse. When those start to arise, we have to be careful of how we're relating to that experience. And so we just, wherever we are, we start to build this capacity. Start where it's easy. It might be just feeling an itch instead of scratching it, opening to that sensation. Okay, I feel a sense of emotion, I want to speak from that. Can I just rest with that a little bit longer before I act from it? Years ago, Rodney was doing these Dharma dialogues, I think he called it. So someone raised their hand and then he would dialogue with them, actually help go with them in deeper and deeper into the question that they had. So one night I had the courage to raise my hand, and it was something around self-doubt or self-disliking. And so as we went into it more and more, he finally said, okay, so what do you do with it now? And it was really to do nothing at all with it. And so when we touch these deep areas of pain, there's such an intensity to want to move from it, to try to act from it, but to just be still with it, just to hold it very gently, and trusting that that's all that's needed, it does take some trust that will work. Now this impulse to move, now when I say move, I mean go into thought, more elaboration, more papancha on it. Where's Daniel? He wanted me to use papancha. Okay, so the papancha is the proliferation of thought. Okay, so we have an impulse and we add more and more thoughts to it. That's a form of movement. Speaking is a form of movement. Certainly acting with our bodies is a form of movement. So I've found in my own practice that tracking this impulse to move is a really critical aspect of investigation. Okay, so that sense of being willing to sit in the middle of our experience, the middle of the fire of our experience, and feeling the body want to shift, maybe a physical shift, a mental shift, a sense of wanting to distract ourselves. So again, having that sense of balance, but when we have enough balance in our attention and we're able to really meet what's arising, to track where do I want to move away from that? Where do I want to shift? So that becomes a very curious place to see, okay, there's that movement. And what I like to do is when I see that sense of movement, actually I want to recommit to connecting with what I want to move from, to even deepen into that more, to see more clearly what is there. So for an example, so let's say I felt rejected, sense of being, okay, someone doesn't like me, or I perceive not being accepted or brought into a group. So there's initial feelings of sadness, of anger, perhaps jealousy. And each one of those has their own impulses to act from. Maybe I'll go mope in the corner, or go, tell someone else, or complain about them, or lash out. There's these impulses to move that are inherent in those feelings of anger, of jealousy, sadness. And you can see, underneath that, there's qualities of greed and hatred. You can see the kind of impersonal root. So we go from the personal to the impersonal, right? To see in these deep qualities of greed, hatred, and delusion. So if I stay still with that, still with the felt sense of the anger, of the jealousy, the sadness, whatever it might be. So the felt sense, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, is the subtle sensations in the body, some subtle sensations and also emotionality, the subtle qualities of thought that may arise. But really the felt sense in the body is the critical piece. Keeping ourselves oriented to that helps us not drift away into thought, drift into more and more elaboration. So if I'm able to sit still with that felt sense of being rejected, not being included, and open to it, it's like at some point when I'm able to open enough to it and relax enough to it, there's a sense of dropping. So that dropping happens paradoxically when I completely open to it. So there's a sense, okay, I'm going to be with this forever. There's no sense of wanting to move or change or do anything different than this with this experience of rejection, but simply to open to it as fully as I can. When I do that, there's no longer any friction with that experience. When there's no longer any friction, it's seen completely. And when it's seen completely, it may drop into a deeper sense of what's driving it. So perhaps a sense of an urge to abandon, you know, being abandoned myself, to give it all up, to run away, to avoid connection, and a more childlike position. And when we touch that, there can even be a stronger urge to move. Because this is we're starting to go down into these deeper unconscious qualities of that drives us in such a strong way. And they often have a much more, almost pre-verbal quality to it. So pre-verbal meaning there's not an intellect. It's like this almost instinctual or animal quality of us. You know, a young child is very driven by their impulses. So that starts to come up. And so then you feel that. And then eventually you drop down even fuller and fuller to see how this forms who you are, how you form the sense of your sense of self. So investigation asks us to open fully to our experience and not act from it unconsciously. Not to act unconsciously from it. This is where it gets very slippery because some of these mind states are so well entrenched, so well incorporated into the fabric of who we are and how we see life, that we start to investigate and observe from that state itself. Right? So we don't realize that it's like our observation is being colored by the very thing we're watching. So let's say sense of rejection. There's a sense of, you know, not belonging, not being loved, not whatever it might be, that subtly comes into how I'm actually seeing it. So there's a subtle friction with that. And in that stage, it's not very pleasant. Because you're seeing the pain, but you're also seeing the pain from the pain itself. Okay, so there's this kind of caught, and it just feels very stuck. But at some point, if you keep being steady with it, keep coming back to the felt sense, making sure your attention is broad, you may shift so you can see it outside of the pain. So the thing that's seeing it is not the pain itself. And then there's suddenly this lightness that comes through it, the sense of space that comes through it. And you realize, okay, this is just a mistaken belief. This is not true. I mean, a few years ago, I was practicing in this way, and had this sense of, you know, self-talk, a sense of self-criticism that popped up. The next thought was, okay, and that's not true. That was a mistake. It was just to see, okay, I was seeing it outside of the state itself. And in that seeing, I could see the deep pain, but the relationship to it is completely different. I'm seeing from the pain, it's like I'm in the middle of it. There's no space. But if I'm seeing from outside of it, then I'm much closer to understanding the sense of non-self, the sense of impermanence and of dukkha. It's this wisdom is coming through as it's observing. And that, as you start to have those experiences, as you start to see, walk yourself through these core issues and start to see the lightness that comes in, then that really reinforces your practice. Because you know, this is the way to help release my suffering. This is the way to connect with it. One way you can work with this is set an intention. You know, set a course on kindness. Okay, I'm going to resolve to live my life from kindness, from a warm heart. Now, if you do that, you may find all the ways that you don't do that come up. You know, you might find yourself being more irritable, more cranky, more, you know, opposite of kindness. So you. But if you're staying on the course, you can say, okay, there's this intention to be kind. And I see all the ways I want to be pulled off. Those are opportunities to investigate, to not begrudge it and say, no, you should be kind. But no, this is where I'm going. So let's feel this sense of unrest, a sense of not deserving, the sense of jealousy, really opening to all these qualities fully. And then kindness naturally becomes the resting state. This sense of intentionality, everything that's not aligned with that starts to show itself, starts to reveal itself. That's where the practice, your spiritual practice, starts to develop this momentum. Right? Because the alignment becomes, your heart and your mind becomes really aligned to this deep release. And everything that's not aligned with that starts to be showing itself. But because you can have this perspective of the deep release, they're held in a much different way than when we're caught with them. So as we listen to ourselves, we learn to listen to ourselves in this way, in this very deep way, without following the impulse to move, and tuning into this felt sense of this experience, we also start to see these deeper self-beliefs start to be seen. These very core, very simple, like, okay, I don't belong, or I'm not loved, or not lovable, or I'm a failure, there's something wrong with me. They're very short, small phrases, but they have so much charge and so much belief packed around them. Now we start to see that, again, from a Buddhist standpoint, they seek the psychological and Buddhism, we can use the psychological to deepen into our spiritual practice. But to help it deepen into the spiritual, we have to be willing to see that these deep beliefs are the way that we form ourselves. You know, like sometimes it feels like this sense of taking some clay and forming it into a person, kind of packing it in. Okay, this is how I've formed myself. Okay, here's a little bit of self-hatred, and here's a bit of self-contempt, and a little bit pride and a little bit of jealousy, and I put all these things in, and that's a sense of self that gets formed. Right? And as we start to look at that, we see, as we start to release it, then we start to see this hunger to want to be, the hunger to not want to be, going back to the second noble truth. So we can see this direct seeing going through our personal story, our personal patterns, going through that into these deep understanding of the second noble truth, the cause of our suffering, the hunger to be, the hunger to not to be, or independent origination, the sense of becoming, the sense of becoming something. Claude Steiner, who was one of the founders of transactional analysis, wrote a book called Scripts People Live. So it's like these deep belief systems. This is how we live our life. It's how we see things. Now these stories, these scripts, sometimes we can approach them dismissively. You know, that's not spiritual. You know, that's just the psychological, right? And if we have to be careful, because that's an easy way to go into what's called spiritual bypassing. When we have some understanding of the three characteristics of non-self, of dukkha, of impermanence, we can say, okay, this personal stuff, there's no self to be having this emotional thing going on, so I'm going to just kind of ignore it, or I'm so wise that it doesn't really affect me, right? So that spiritual bypass, this is true investigation is a good antidote to that, because we were learning to see, where am I constricting? Where am I forming myself? Because these stories are actually very profound. It's like if we had like a children's story, like the three little pigs. Okay, so we all know how the story goes. Okay, so we all have these own stories about ourselves, how this is how I act around my parents, or around my spouse, or around my boss. They're often very unconscious. Now, if you're reading the three little pigs, and then suddenly Godzilla comes in and crushes one of the pigs' houses, that doesn't fit into this story. But because these stories have so much momentum, we just kind of brush that off. Oh, that didn't really happen. We just keep going on with this story. And same thing with these personal stories. Let's say there's a sense of inadequacy, and that's just, I keep rehearsing that and going over and over, and someone says, wow, I really like you. You did a really good job. It's like I'm brushing that whole side of this thing away because it doesn't fit in to this story. Okay, so the desire to become, to form my sense of self in this sense of diminishment outweighs the positive. I disregard it. Because these stories have a very pervasive thought, a logic that we try to see the whole world from, try to make everything fit into that logic. So with pervasive stories that we all have, there's two ways I'll suggest to work with them. First one is just to hold it very simply. So you start to get a sense of these deeper stories, just to resist the impulse to move, to elaborate, to act from it. Because when you elaborate, when you act from it, and elaboration includes thinking about it, adding more and more to it, you're deepening the groove. You're making it more prominent. It reinforces it. So just connect with the direct experience. Where is it felt in the body? What does it actually feel like? So this just takes some courage to open to it, to fully open and turn our hearts to it. The second is to start to notice when there's gaps in that story, when life doesn't quite match up to that. Let's say you're worried about missing an appointment, being late to it. If I'm late to it, I'm going to get criticized, I'm going to be judged. There's this whole story that arises. Then notice when it actually happens, did that play through? You see how there's a gap often. Our idea of how reality is isn't reality often. But so often we just kind of brush that away. Like that three little pigs story in Godzilla, oh, that doesn't fit in. Okay, but we notice that gap and bring your attention to that gap. Okay, so that gap, if you really tune into it, it's a little disorienting because it doesn't fit into how I think things should be. Okay, but you start to open that disorientation, you realize that a disorientation is also a sense of freedom, a sense of wonder that's arising into the moment. Okay, what's really going on in this experience? Not what I think is going to happen or should happen. And as you do that, you realize there's more freedom by releasing the story than by holding the story. And so that's a tipping point that we all go through, that we start to realize holding on to this story, this self-belief, this sense of self, causes more suffering. And the release of that, that constriction leads to less suffering. The freedom from suffering. And so then it becomes self-reinforcing. So we learn to step out of our stories, not by creating a new story, but having a very different relationship to life that's not dependent upon the story. It's very available to what's arising in myself and what's arising in the environment. So I'm trying to give you a sense of, you can take any conflict in your life, and the homework speaks to that, to notice when you feel this emotional charge. Okay, instead of acting from it, I like to think of suspending the need to act. Okay, I'm just going to be still with this. I'm going to open to the felt sense of this emotionality. Notice there may be a movement this way or that way, but being still, you can observe it much more clearly. Being still with it, then we start to see there's these deeper beliefs that may arise. And following that down further and further, we start to get a very concrete and tangible sense of this, these three characteristics. What does it feel like to to live from non-self, to live from anatta, or from anicca, from dukkha? It's almost like a sunken ship. You can just see the masts poking out. We take the masks as being the whole picture. But if we start to follow it down, we start to feel and sense the whole framework of the whole ship, down to the ribs of the ship and the whole structure, to the core of it. So too with our lives. You know, every friction that you have is an invitation, a gateway to deepen into your practice. And touching this external charge and holding it in this way of investigation allows us to start to see its deepest roots. So in this way, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion really become very tangible, very concrete for us. We can see them very clearly. So I've emphasized the difficulty, because the difficulty is often what drives so much of our life, our reactivity. But for each one of us, there's times when there is absent, when there's a quality relating to experience, which is not based in craving and aversion and movement toward or against. There's just a natural stillness. So where's investigation come in with those qualities? And when there's a nice natural balance of mind, when there's a quality of non-clinging toward experience. So investigation in that way starts to become more subtle to see where is the subtle qualities of forming an opinion, forming a position, forming a sense of identity around this experience. And it becomes very quiet, very subtle, open to that, and releasing it. And in the heart, it's a sense of more and more surrendering. And what can I surrender to even more deeply in this moment? Even more deeply surrender this sense of resistance, the sense of need to be, the need to not be. And then ultimately, we start to see the very looking, the sense of, okay, I'm looking, I have this sense of needing to do something with my experience. It's part of this subtle position, the subtle self. At that point, we release that, even that. And the Buddha said that you build this raft and you carry it across, gets you to the other shore. But once you get ashore, you don't keep carrying the raft around. You set it down. So at some point, even that bit of, okay, there's something that needs to be done, there's this complete release into this moment's perfection, just as it is. All right, let's just be quiet for a moment or two. Thank you for your attention. And so we have some time for comments, questions. Yes, Kathy. Yes. Right. Absolutely. So the question is about a coworker who is kind of an ongoing sense of fear when she relates to her, fear of being yelled at and being perhaps attacked in some way. And practicing for years, it sounds like just, okay, feeling it and being with it, but it continues. There's just feel like, it feels like you're kind of in a stuck spot with it. And so that, I mean, that's a great opportunity for investigation. Because I think in some way we kind of get this message that meditation is passive activity. That, okay, if I just have to open to it and be still with it, then I'll be okay. The trouble with that is that when we get still, we kind of, before we get still, we kind of create this whole framework of, okay, this is the unconscious part, this is the conscious part, this is a part I'm accepting and not accepting. It's just kind of like this program that comes up before, as we boot the computer, the operating system pops up. And so that's, even though we're being still with it, that operating system prevents us from seeing clearly what's behind the scenes. So often it's helpful when you say, okay, there's a sense of fear that comes up. Looking with it to the point where you get surprised by it. That sense of surprise opens the door. So fear often, anger, there's a sense of anger that's not being acknowledged. Because, you know, as a good meditator, of course I'm not angry, right? But if I start to feel that sense of, you know, so that's the part of, okay, I'm just kind of guessing or elaborating, kind of generalizing it. But if there's an emotion that I don't allow in my experience, and then I start to feel that sense of, okay, you know, I'm really pissed about this. I'm really angry about this. Okay, then things start to move. It's like, oh, the fear is really, there's this anger underneath it. And I start to open to this sense of anger. And once you start to get a hold of it, you start to, it's like I've used this analogy on the first night, the bloodhound that's starting to sense this, following the scent that's very subtle. Okay. So you're connecting with this sense of anger, feeling it mostly in the body, but you know, there's some small beliefs that come up. And you get to the point where you start to realize that this person's most likely a placeholder. Okay, they're representing somebody else. You know, it's 90% of the time it's some family of origin. It's parents, or also siblings too. It's amazing how much siblings also have that quality of, you know, this person's really upsetting to me, and I realize, oh, this reminds me of this relationship with my brother or my sister or my father or my mother. Okay, so I start to be more and more still with that. And then you start to reorient this fear, present day fear, that I imagine is, I mean, she's not like throwing stones at you or anything, right?
Not yet.
Okay, so assuming that there's not a real threat, but there's this much deeper belief that's held in there. So how to say that in a clearer way? Like for myself, I was going through this, really exploring this sense of projection on this person. And I would, you know, work with it, and you know, just like you said, it was really difficult. There's a point of being very, very difficult. No way out. Just I was hoping to it, but I was really still charged. So that's what I mean by seeing it with still being within the pain at seeing it. Okay. So at one point, though, then I through asking these kind of questions, you can be very creative. So like, what do I need to see, or what am I not seeing in this? What's being hidden? What am I believing in? And just floating that question, kind of walking with that question for a few weeks, and you may see it shifts. Okay, there's this deeper belief. Okay, my anger's not okay. That's just the beginning of deepening, right? You start to, okay, well, anger. And you start to, so again, back to this example of this person, I was having a lot of projection around. Eventually I saw that my fear of being judged by this person was much more related to this very deep fear of being abandoned as a little kid. I realized, okay, there's a sense of survival. So when I feel this sense of fear being judged, it's really this sense of fear of surviving. And when I connected this really archaic piece to this present thing, I realized, well, these don't have anything to do with each other. This is not about surviving in this moment. so then I can start to tend to this deeper pain. Right? So, you know, if anger is something that resonates, start to tend to that sense of being angry. Okay, so you bring your compassion to that. And then naturally it starts to open up in different ways. You're welcome. And then just to complete the what makes this feel different for me than psychological work, because there's a strong psychological component we're talking about. What makes it different is that this sense of unbinding, the sense of I open to this, there's a sense of loosening my sense of self. Right? Instead of forming a stronger sense of self, there's a sense of loosening that. Now, caveat, sometimes we do have to form a stronger sense of self, more self-esteem, so we feel this sense of empowerment. But this way of seeing these deeper beliefs, okay, this is how I form my sense of self. Because I see underneath that, there's a stillness that's before I form. And that's what orients my practice, that opening to that deep stillness. Muffin.
Thanks for that. That last part of it was very helpful. I'm always really impressed with how you wrap it up. I want to just ask a little bit more about that piece. It seems like there's some times where you can see that most of your thoughts are imaginary, most of them untrue. It seems
right.
Very obvious.
Right.
And yet the conditioning seems very similar the next day, that you're still having those patterns.
Yeah, right.
I'm wondering
right.
If you can speak to what you can expect with a deep belief in the untrueness of your thoughts. The conditioning is still going to keep going. Do you expect for those thoughts of trying to fix things or being angry or whatever, even though you yesterday knew they weren't true, do you still expect ongoing to keep having those impulses? Or is there an end to that also?
So the question is with a seeing that our thoughts or impulses or beliefs aren't true, but the next day they may rise again. Is there an end to that? Is there a way that they start to really resolve? Does that capture the question? You know, often when we find things coming back, there's still this quality of it not being fully seen. Right? And it does seem to be that we have these different areas that we have to learn to open to. So, you know, just pick one area, you know, one common pattern that comes up. So you can see the truth of this doesn't make sense, this is not true. But you have to see it not just with the mind, you have to see it with the heart, and you have to feel it in the body. So it has to be such a radical sense of seeing it. And that really starts to undercut the engine that drives it. So there's a quality of unconsciousness, unconscious belief, or unconscious fully opening to it. We're not fully open to it, that keeps it going. So I remember being on retreat, you know, and Rodney would talk about, you know, relaxing with experience. Okay, so I got that, you know, and so years later, okay, relax more. Okay, I understand that more deeply. So I felt like I was deepening into that. Then one retreat, the sense of, okay, something shift in a way that I really felt this, okay, this is what it really means to relax. It was a shifting into the heart. And there was tremendous sobbing and crying, you know, tears that would just go on. But it was held in a way, it was like I could feel this is the heart opening. So it wasn't traumatic or uncomfortable. It was a sense, this is the heart opening to this deep pain. And I had a sense of seeing, you know, like the, kind of the cliche when someone's about to die, they see their whole life flashback. So I could see all these instances of causing suffering to myself by resisting life. So with these patterns, you have to be very patient with them and keep opening to it, but try to shift to a different way of relating to it. Just like shifting from fear to anger. Okay, so shifting, how can I relate to this in a very different way? And when that starts to happen, then the foundation starts to fall away. Okay? And so that comes up in a very different, starts to come up less and less, because you're seeing, you're really embodied, you're seeing it in an embodied way, seeing those three characteristics in an embodied way, seeing the three unwholesome roots in an embodied way. So it becomes very, very clear in you. And then you might go home and visit with your parents, and then boom, it pops back up. And that's okay. Then you realize, okay, then there's that's not. So then there's more, there's, I can look at it in this way too. But once you start to see through it, then you're no longer completely believe in it. It's really loosened its foundation.
And it feel like it's possibly progressive.
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely becomes progressive. It definitely becomes a deepening. If there's that sense of looking, we can spend years and years kind of caught in this superficial way. Because don't underestimate the power of being unconscious. I mean, it's so powerful. The Buddha talked about the core root is ignorance, or wanting to be unconscious, being deluded about how things are. And from that, everything else springs, and greed and hatred and sense of self, everything springs from that. So it's this very core quality, right? And the embodiment is Mara. And even after the Buddha was awakened, for at least 7 years, from what I can tell, reading some of the suttas, the Mara would pop up and would try to trick him. And that's like our unconscious coming in. But the Buddha would say, "I see you, Mara." And the Mara would go away, discouraged, and disappear. But then he would come up again. So it's this, I think it's helpful not to have this movement of trying to arrive someplace to get this place of trying to be free of this. Because when I'm trying to be free of something, I haven't completely opened to it. That's a paradox. When I'm completely open to it, okay, this is me really, really, really open to this pattern, even completely to every cell in my being. When I really do that, then it releases in a very deep way. But if I'm opening into it in order to release, then there's that unconscious quality. Yeah, it's a very interesting journey. But it becomes interesting. You say, you start to even look forward to when you get triggered. It's like, oh, wow, I got triggered there. What's that about? Because there's a whole lightness to it. But until we see the way through it, there's a heaviness that arises with it. Is there a question back there? Sure. Hatred? Yeah. Okay, so the question is, greed and hatred, is that the equivalent of attachment and aversion? Yes and no. Often we think of aversion and attachment, or craving, as being a form of a hindrance, this movement toward it. If we look deep enough, we see there's this much deeper root of hatred and greed. I don't like those words so much, but that sense of wanting and not wanting. So this is a very almost existential quality to it. It's a very deep quality. So it's like saying the raindrop is the same as the lake. They both have the same substance, but there's this much deeper reservoir of it for greed and hatred. And greed and hatred are created through delusion, through a sense of ignorance, not understanding, the three characteristics. And that's what creates delusion, and that creates, there's a natural expression of that is into this greed and hatred. And then aversion is this quality, it's connected. It's like the stream is connected to the lake, but the lake is much, much bigger. Yeah, George. Okay. Okay. So basically the question is elaborating more on that last question, is the difference between desire versus greed and hatred versus aversion. You know, what really is the difference? So from my own experience, when I'm caught by aversion or caught by greed, it's very contextual, or it was very based on the context of things. I want that experience. I don't want that. So it's like I'm already at this level. I've kind of created this whole infrastructure. My sense of self is a given. The sense of wanting it, that this thing I want or don't want is dependent upon my, that's going to make me happy. So it's like this whole logic that's built up. If I go down to the very base of that structure, the very foundation of it, that's where I start to feel that just that almost existential wanting to be something. Is that, and so for myself, knowing that I'm touching that, when I contemplate releasing that, there's fear that arises. Okay, so if I release this quality of wanting, of let's say greed or of desire, sorry, I try to keep my syntax right. If I release a sense of greed, there's a fear of not existing. Okay, and the same thing with a sense of hatred. If I release that, there's this fear of, okay, what's, so this characteristic of non-self pops up. And the belief in self pops up. Okay, so believing in a sense of self, or that deep belief in it, you know, and of course I'm going to feel this sense of greed and hatred. If I release greed and hatred, I also have to release the sense of self. So those are very tied. Okay, so this is a very subtle, very, you know, very quiet. You know, it's like a movement of a millimeter is like a difference of a world. You know, if that makes sense. There's a little shift makes this huge ramification, moving this way or that way. Out here, it's like I can do all this stuff. It's still based in that, but if there's this whole elaboration, there's much more layers of unconscious which is built up around it, belief structure that's built up around it. Does that help? And so the gateway is just, you know, follow wherever you are. I don't think it's so helpful to try to figure out, am I, this really delusion, is this really greed or is it really desire? Just to notice, what does it really feel like, and open to it, and that opening, I'll naturally fall my way down. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't know the Pali, but I think they're different words. Yeah. You're welcome. Maybe one more question? Comment? Yes. Right. Right. Yeah. This sense of grief feels bothersome. This sense of grief feels bothersome. Right. So just to repeat that for the viewers, so the comment is following this down, this more superficial emotion to be able to follow down to this show its shift. So you realize, I figured it was anger that shift to sadness or vice versa, or yeah. So there's, right. Right. So again, just to rephrase or paraphrase the question. So, this movement from a superficial quality to a much deeper quality, you know, feels very fulfilling, but there's a sense of regret that why haven't I done this 10 years ago? Why all this life has been wasted because I've been living from this way instead of connecting with this. It may be a quality of the grief really needs to be expressed. Because instead of being this bothersome, you know, visitor that you'd rather not have there, it's like to really open to that grief, to really feel the impact of this. Because when you really clearly see how you've created suffering unnecessarily, I mean, the heart grieves with that. It's like the sense of, many times in retreats, I've just needed to go out in the woods and sob because there's just so much to bear. It's like, oh, you know, there's so much unnecessary suffering that I've caused myself. That seeing of that unnecessary suffering and really grieving it clears that out, and it creates this resolve to not live from that and allows the joy to come up. It's like, okay, you know, that it's like the water has already gone down the bridge. There's that grief from that loss of life. But there's this realization that life is really lived in this moment. So by grieving fully, so giving yourself some private time, you know, so maybe walking in the woods or, you know, some time where you can really let yourself cry. Really, or maybe journal, write to the grief. There's different ways you can do it. You can find what works for you. And then once you start to really give that grief a voice, you find that then that energy is dissipated. And then you're able to really live that insight in a different way. Yeah, so, you know, don't begrudge it. Open to it. All right, so we need to stop. So thank you for your kind attention and your practice.